Good evening. Welcome to KPFT 90.1 FM. This is Mark Rabawi welcoming you to another edition of the Sunday Monitor. Perky Anderson has the week off this week, but she should be joining us again soon. On behalf of Perky Anderson and Byron Jackson and the entire KPFT family, I would like to thank all the listeners who called in their support over the past 2 weeks. With their help and with your help, we were able to go beyond our weekly goal of $1,200. 2 weeks ago, we raised almost $1,400, and last week's show raised almost $1,600. Thank you very, very much for all of your support. You keep us on the air. You keep KPFT going. Obviously, if you didn't make your pledge by credit card, then you'll probably be getting a bill in the mail. So please don't forget to send that in. The pledge is only the first half of the equation. Tonight, we have a live interview with former presidential interpreter Fred Burks. We had him on about 3 weeks ago, and we were very short of time. He had a lot of things to say, so we have him on tonight for an extended interview. He's going to be with us live. He served in the Department of State for 18 years, resigned citing excessive secrecy. Since then, he says he's seen patterns of cover-up and manipulation. Some of the themes we'll touch on tonight will be familiar to regular listeners of the show. You'll get to hear about real-world experiences from a former insider who acted as interpreter to Presidents Bush and Clinton, as well as Dick Cheney and many, many others. So that is our one and only live interview for tonight. We may be getting a phone call during the show from Sybil Edmonds, who we've had on also. She had a break in her case recently. She won the first part of her case. The government was trying to retroactively classify information that had been in the public domain about her, her allegations, the languages she translated, and so on. The ACLU and a couple of other groups filed suit on her behalf, and the government backed down, basically. If we're able to get her on the phone tonight, we'll talk about some more details of that case. But in case we're not, that's kind of it in a nutshell. We're also hoping to get Greg Palace on the show pretty soon. He's written about a lot of topics. You will have probably be familiar with his election work and some other things. But he's also written extensively about Latin America. And he's met with Hugo Chavez several times. Hugo Chavez is the subject of our first news headline tonight. The Venezuelan Foreign Minister, Ali Rodriguez, warned on Friday that the Bush administration may be plotting to overthrow his country's leader, Hugo Chavez, in what he called a throwback to Washington's long history of gunboat diplomacy in Latin America. In a speech at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, Rodriguez added fuel to the fire burning between the White House and Chavez, saying the U.S. officials' recent criticisms of the Venezuelan president were ignorant and arrogant. Those are Rodriguez's words. He said, quote, "There have been lots of attacks against Venezuela from the United States recently. We have lots of prior experience with this sort of thing," unquote. He was citing successful CIA-influenced overthrows of leaders in Guatemala in 54, the Dominican Republic in 65, and Chile in 1973. Those familiar with the history of Chile will know that 73 was another 9/11. It was September 11th, 1973, when the Allende government was overthrown with some CIA backing. Rodriguez is one of Hugo Chavez's closest advisors. He's been the main strategist behind Venezuela's push to rally other leading oil exporters to cut production and increase prices. A Marxist guerrilla since the 60s, Rodriguez later became Secretary General of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, as well as Venezuela's oil minister and president of its state-owned oil monopoly, Petróleos de Venezuela. In the escalating rhetoric between Caracas and Washington, Chavez warned in a radio address last week of a U.S. assassination plot and threatened to stop supplying oil to the United States if it makes an attempt on his life. Condoleezza Rice, in her Senate confirmation hearings last month, became Secretary of State, said the United States, quote, "cannot remain indifferent to what Venezuela is doing beyond its borders," unquote. This was a hint to Chavez's close relationship with Cuba and his support for leftist movements in the region. Like I said, we're hoping to be talking to Greg Palast about this. He's a Latin America expert, although you may not be familiar with that side of his work. If you want to read his website, it's gregpalast.com. You'll find on the left-hand side a whole bunch of links, and one of them is Latin America. Check that out if you have time. It's a little difficult to read all the headlines solo, so excuse me while I try and breathe between these headlines. Pokey will be joining us next week, as I said. One of four Britons released from Guantanamo Bay last month said he was tortured by American forces there at a separate holding camp and spent many hours trussed like an animal with a bag over his head. Muazzam Beg, a 37-year-old, was released by the Metropolitan Police in the UK without charge and reunited with his wife and four children after 3 years of imprisonment. He also accuses his American captors of beating two detainees to death in the Bagram Air Base near Kabul in Afghanistan. His first interview since his release, he told Channel 4 News in the UK that he witnessed two people get beaten so badly he believed it caused their deaths. On February of 2003, Mr. Beg was transferred from Bagram to Guantanamo in Cuba. The former law student and a bookshop owner from Birmingham joined hundreds of other unlawful combatants, so-called, shackled and dressed in orange jumpsuits, then held without charge, trial, or access to lawyers. For much of his detention, he was in solitary confinement, often exposed to extreme weather and deprived of basic necessities. Last night, he said he was interviewed at Guantanamo by U.S. secret security forces who asked him to identify the guards in the alleged beatings. He told Channel 4 News, quote, I saw one body actually being carried away, and the other one, I wasn't sure whether he had been killed, but the photographs the American intelligence officers brought to my interview confirmed this person had been killed, unquote. Speaking of Guantanamo and detention, there's been a lot of speculation about how people are transported to Guantanamo and other prisons, as well as to states for what is called extraordinary rendition. This is a U.S. government term, meaning that people can be transported in secret to a state that the U.S. has a relationship with, where they can be questioned, sometimes in contravention of U.S. laws. For example, one Canadian, Maher Arar, was deported from the U.S. to Syria, where he was tortured. Anyway, next week's edition of Newsweek magazine will contain a report on secret U.S. flights. Part of the article will read as follows. Aviation obsessives with cameras and internet connections have become a threat to cover stories established by the CIA to mask its undercover operations and personnel overseas. U.S. intel sources complain that the plane spotters made it possible for the CIA critics to recently assemble details of clandestine transport systems the agency had set up to secretly move cargo and people, including terrorist suspects, around the world. Web searches revealed that plane spotters have posted numerous photos on the web of two planes. One is a small Gulfstream jet and the other a mid-sized Boeing 737. Excuse me, they're both registered to obscure companies suspected of CIA connections. Some of the pictures were taken at airports in foreign countries where CIA activities could be controversial. When the 737 last year went through a change of tail number and ownership, a suspicious company in suburban Boston transferred the plane to a similar company in Reno, Nevada. Internet searches of aviation and public records databases disclosed details of the plane's new owners and registration number. One critical database established accessible via Google was a recent aircraft registry maintained by the government's own Federal Aviation Administration. A U.S. intel source acknowledged that the instant availability of such data and photos on the internet is not helpful, quote, if your objective is clandestinity, unquote. If you want to see how it works, go to the web for info on business jet carrying, for example, the Liechtenstein tail numbers HB-IES. The search should turn up pictures of that plane at a European airport, as well as public records of news stories describing how the plane registered to a company called Aviatrans once belonged to Saddam Hussein. Unusual, perhaps. Anyway, if you get Newsweek, look out for that article next week. Iran and Russia signed a nuclear fuel agreement on Sunday, paving the way for Iran to set up its first reactor. Iranian Vice President Gholam Mirza Abdelghazi and Alexander Rumyantsev, the head of Russia's Federal Atomic Energy Agency, signed the agreement in Bushehr, a nuclear power plant. The signing, which was delayed by a day, came after the two senior officials toured the $800 million complex. Russia, which helped build the plant, has agreed to provide the fuel needed to run it, but only if Iran returns the spent fuel to prevent any possibility that Tehran would extract plutonium from it and make an atomic bomb. Tehran has agreed, but both sides have disagreed on how they should pay for the return. The signing came a few days after a summit between President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Slovakia, which touched on American concerns over Russian support for Iran's nuclear program, Washington accuses Tehran of covertly trying to build a nuclear bomb, which Iran denies. Putin said that he is sure Iran's intentions are merely to generate energy, not create weapons, and that Russian cooperation with Tehran would continue. It wasn't immediately clear whether the meeting on Thursday between Bush and Putin had delayed the signing, which was expected on Saturday. And the deputy head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization said that it did not. If you caught the meeting between Bush and Putin, you would have seen Vladimir Putin kind of get a dressing down about Russian democracy and free press and the need for such things. One would have to wonder about those who are living in glass houses, but we won't go into that. Maybe Fred will have a comment. Fred Brooks is going to be our interview. Excuse me, is coming up next. One more final headline about the Iraq war. Halliburton, which is under security scrutiny for contracts in Iraq, would receive an extra $1.5 billion as part of the Bush administration's additional war spending proposal for 2005. This is according to a senior U.S. Army budget official. If approved by Congress, that would bring the total spending under Kellogg-Brannon-Root's contract to about $6 billion for 2005, about the same amount spent a year earlier. The official declined to estimate how much the Army would spend on the contract in 2006, but said the top U.S. commander in Baghdad was putting a big emphasis on controlling costs by setting clear standards for services provided. Speaking of war profits, the Iraq war helped bring record earnings to a St. Louis-based defense contract company called Engineering Support Systems. William H.T. Bucky Bush, the uncle of the president and the youngest brother of former President George H.W. Bush, cashed in ESSI stocks last month and made $448,000. Uncle Bucky, as he is known to the president, is on the board of the company, which supplies armor and other material to U.S. troops. The company's stock prices have soared to record heights since the invasion of Iraq. I'm going to take a very short break right now, and when we come back, we have a live interview with Fred Burks, former presidential translator and interpreter. Stay tuned. Listening to the Sunday Monitor, we're joined live now by Fred Burks, a former presidential interpreter, 18 years as an Indonesian interpreter in the State Department, translated for President Clinton, President Bush, Al Gore, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Madeleine Albright, and many others. Fred, welcome back to the Sunday Monitor.
Hi, Mark, and listeners. Great to be back on the show again.
Well, I know we shortchanged you a little bit last time you were on, and we had a lot of material to cover, and of course we never got to most of it, and I suspect we're going to be experiencing similar problems today.
Mm-hmm.
We have about 30 minutes.
Okay.
Because coming on right after you, we have an interview with Greg Palast, who will be joining us.
Excellent.
To talk about Hugo Chavez, and also to give people, an on-air obituary for Hunter S. Thompson. I'm not sure if you followed the news of his passing.
Sure.
Do you care to comment on Hunter Thompson before we move on to any of the other topics we're going to cover?
Well, he was a true character, you know, from everything that I've read. He's one of those people who struck out and did what he believed was the right thing and raised a lot of controversy, but also gave some real good information.
Yeah, and he's going to be missed by a lot of people, and it was... it's always sad to hear people going, let alone the way he did, but Greg, I suspect, will put some of his work into perspective for us.
Great.
Let's start with just a quick summary of who you are and what your experiences are. I mentioned at the top of the hour that you had 18 years of experience with the State Department, but tell us a little bit more about that, some more specific details of your work and where you went and the things that you experienced, if possible.
Sure. I lived overseas in Indonesia for a year and in China for 2 years, and when I got back home, I was looking for a job and ended up becoming an interpreter with the State Department back in 1986. And then without even trying, there's a whole kind of funny story to that, I moved up the ranks and eventually in 1995 got my first phone call asking me to interpret at the highest levels. And in that year, I interpreted at the White House, a meeting between Clinton and then-President Suharto of Indonesia. And since then, I've gone on, eventually became their number one Indonesian interpreter at the State Department, and I've interpreted several times for Bush, and then, as you mentioned, for Vice Presidents Cheney and Gore and Powell and Albright, Secretary of State, and a number of other world leaders.
Now, when you were working in Indonesia, one of the meetings that kind of sticks out, which we did touch on last time, was September 16th of 2002. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, this is the one that has drawn quite a bit of press attention lately.
I should mention, actually, that this was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Were you surprised to get mainstream attention about this subject?
I certainly was. You know, I was expecting to have some press attention, particularly in Indonesia, but the fact that it actually made to the front page of the Wall Street Journal last week was quite a surprise and very welcome. And by the way, I should mention to the listeners that I manage a website that's all about exposing major cover-ups and working together for the good of all. And that website is www.wanttoknow.info.
And there's also a copy of the Wall Street Journal article on there in case you're not a subscriber.
That's right. In fact, if you go to wanttoknow.info, you'll see on the left side there's buttons. Click on the cover-up archive button. And if you go to the most recent entry is the Wall Street Journal article, and there are links direct to the Wall Street Journal website, and also which you have to pay to view, also a free copy of the same page on our website.
Now, Fred, the reason I wanted to bring this meeting up again, even though we touched on it last time, is we got quite a bit of listener feedback about this, and several people said that we should have you back on foot and give you more time because they felt like they only got a slight taste. So if you could give us... first of all, why was this meeting significant, and what happened in it? Who are the players, and where do you see this leading? And if I'm not asking too many questions, why is this part of a larger picture? Where do you place this in a bigger context?
Sure, great questions. First, I'll just mention that many people may not have heard the name of Abu Bakar Bashir. This is supposedly an Indonesian terrorist who heads up the sister organization to Al-Qaeda, which is called Jama'ah Islamiyah, or JI. And the fact is that in Indonesia, many people suspect that it is the U.S. and foreign pressures that are wanting to create this terrorist network that doesn't actually exist, and sort of fabricating all sorts of things to make this guy look very evil and like a terrorist.
Now, this is a very strong statement that you just made. I'm sure people are going to be raising eyebrows. Explain a little bit more what you mean when you say this a terrorist organization that doesn't exist.
Okay, well, I'm not saying it doesn't exist at all, so I want to make myself clear here. But basically, what you find, and if I highly encourage everyone to look at the BBC documentary Power of Nightmares, which you can find also on our website. You can get actually view it for free through a link there. And what the BBC documentary Power of Nightmares shows is that there are certain... powerful groups, let's call them the power elite, who would like for us to be in fear, thus the name Power of Nightmares, because if we are in fear, then we're willing to put much more money into the government and the military-industrial complex to protect us. This, of course, brings lots of profit back to the power elite. So the purpose behind it all is then to create a sense of fear in the world. Now, how do we do that? Well, we can, you know, find certain organizations that can become targeted as the evil empire. You know, it used to be Russia back in the old days, but then the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
When the wall came down, they had to find a new organization, and after 9/11, that was, of course, Al-Qaeda. And anybody who's linked to Al-Qaeda is, of course, part of the evil empire.
But of course, I mean, September 11th was a very real event. I mean, it's going to upset some people if you start to question the legitimacy of targeting an organization that carried out that attack, don't you think?
Oh, sure. And, you know, this is a really important piece. It's not even important to talk about, you know, what really happened on 9/11, though you can find lots of information on our website. We specialize in revealing major, reliable, verifiable information on what happened on 9/11 that was not dealt with by the commission.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And actually, I mean, regular listeners to this show will be familiar with a lot of that stuff. We've had Sybil Edmonds and David Ray Griffin and others. And I think I'm not going out on too much of a limb to say that the view of this show is that we don't really understand, at least from the public record and the official version, what exactly happened on September 11th. There are a lot of questions that need to be investigated, not the least of which is the intelligence issues. And Sybelle Edmonds, I mentioned in the news at the top, won the first part of her case, yep. where the government was trying to retroactively classify publicly known information. So there's a lot that needs to be discussed about September 11th, and I don't think the commission has answered the majority of the important questions. But if we assume that the official version is true for the time being, mm-hmm. Place for us the Jamaat Islamiya and Abu Bakr Bashir and this in the larger context of what you were talking about in terms of the power of nightmares.
Sure, and I just want to make clear that I do not assume that it was as stated, that in fact I'm fairly convinced that 9/11 was at the very least allowed to happen and most likely manipulated. And you can see the very solid evidence for that on the website, wantoknow.info. Now,
I'm sure you'll be getting a few hits after this show is over.
Now, getting back then to Jamaat Islamiya, which is considered the sister organization in Southeast Asia of Al-Qaeda,
mm-hmm.
what you find is that if you really start exploring who are these people and what are they doing, that they don't have a lot of money. You know, the claim is that Al-Qaeda has tremendous amounts of money. And yes, they do have money, but comparative to the amount of money that's poured into our intelligence services and military, it is relatively small. And neither are they that organized. And again, the BBC documentary, Power of Nightmares, lays this out very clearly. And
to give a slight sort of a statistical comparison here for people, Osama bin Laden was supposedly, you know, the financial muscle behind Al-Qaeda for a number of years, and his personal wealth was estimated at roughly $300 million. But there's some debate about how accurate that number is. Kellogg Brown and Root is going to make $6.1 billion this year out of the Iraq invasion, just to give people a slight context there.
Sure, and then we're soon going to hit the $300 billion mark on war spending for Afghanistan and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're talking a 1-to-1,000 ratio here.
Right.
Now, and for those who are interested, I highly, highly recommend the BBC documentary Power of Nightmares, and you can find that by going to wanttoknow.info, clicking then on the cover-up archive and finding January 22nd, 2005. For those listeners who have pen and paper handy, you might want to have it ready because I can mention a number of great links. There you can actually view this documentary online for free. So getting back then to this secret meeting,
mm-hmm.
Basically what happened is, as I said, in about 2001 is really when I became the top interpreter at the State Department in Indonesia. So in 2002, on a Friday afternoon, I got a call from Karen Brooks, who is the Director of Asian Affairs at the National Security Council. This is a very high-level intelligence position, and I had become friends with her through working with her in dealings with the President of Indonesia, Megawati Sukarno Putri, who happens to be a good personal friend of Karen Brooks.
Okay.
So Karen said, "Hey, Fred," this was on Friday, she called, Can you leave tomorrow and go with me to interpret at a secret meeting in Jakarta with Megawati?" And, you know, luckily I had nothing planned, and so I said, "Sure, let's go." So we got there, and
so would this meeting have been official State Department business or not?
No, this is a secret meeting.
So I mean, there's no record of it.
State Department. The State Department arranged all my tickets and paid for everything. So yes, this certainly was.
So you can prove that it actually happened then, at least.
Oh, if you read the Wall Street Journal article, there are many quotes in there stating, you know, Karen Brooks acknowledges this meeting exists.
Okay.
She will just deny that what I'm saying happened.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what are you saying happened in this meeting then?
What actually happened was there was a woman who was introduced as a special assistant sent directly from President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the way, this woman, before we met, acknowledged to me that she was a CIA agent. First time somebody had ever admitted that to me. But anyway, that was not mentioned to the president of Indonesia. So she was there with the ambassador to Indonesia from the United States, Ralph Boyce, and Karen Brooks and myself in her in Megawati's private home. And basically, the special assistant said that President Bush would like Megawati to render Abu Bakr Bashir to the United States. Now, rendering is a special term in intelligence, services. That means to secretly capture and turn over to another country.
Maybe he would have been put on one of those two planes that I mentioned in the news. I don't know if you
exactly.
caught that. Did you catch part of the news when you were on hold or not?
I'm sorry?
Did you catch that part of the news? I'm not sure how early you were called.
I did not hear that earlier, no,
okay,
but I know all about those flights.
Earlier in the news, I was updating people on a couple of privately held jets that are used for extraordinary rendition, so this kind of ties in here.
Yes, I'm very familiar with that. So, basically, this guy was going to disappear, as far as everyone would tell, and then be turned over secretly to the United States, and no one would ever know what happened. But now Megawati, interestingly enough, resisted and said, no, I can't do that. This guy is too well known. And just for the listeners, this guy, Abu Bakr al-Bashir, is something like a Pat Robertson or a Jerry Falwell. In other words, you know, he's a Muslim version. He wants Indonesia to have a Muslim government and wants, you know, the world to be run on Muslim principles. But he, as far as I can see, and I've really researched this carefully since all of this has happened, he has never called on people to commit terrorist acts. He wants them to do it, you know, like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson through normal channels. But anyway, the U.S. And international community in some ways seem intent on making him out to be an evil terrorist. So Megawati resisted, and then the CIA agent, the special assistant, put more pressure, said, look, if he's not turned over within 6 weeks, there's going to be some problems. And Megawati's response was, I hope this doesn't lead to a severing of the good relationship between our two countries.
Hmm.
And they were quite shocked to hear her stand up that strongly. I was, too. I was sort of going, whoa, this is pretty heavy stuff.
What do you know of her relationship with Bashir? Do they have one? I mean, are they
between
cooperative?
Megawati and Bashir?
Yeah.
No, I don't think they've even ever met.
Hmm.
I mean, she certainly knows about him, just as everybody knows about Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson.
And since you've met her personally, what are her religious views? Is she favoring the kind of Islamic State that he
Not
calls for?
Not in the least. She is quite moderate. She mixes sort of the local religion with Islam. But she doesn't talk about it much. She's very much a secular president. There's no one who would claim at all that she's a fundamentalist in the least. Whereas Abu Bakr al-Bashir clearly is a fundamentalist Muslim who wants the world to be converted to Islam and run on Muslim principles.
So at this point, I guess I'd have to ask you to speculate on what they would have done with him had Megawati allowed them to capture him. What do you think was the aim?
Our readers could almost guess that he would have ended up in Guantanamo, mm-hmm. subject to these special treatment methods to extract information. And possibly even, I believe, that what happens is they program information into these people.
Hmm.
Through special mind control techniques.
Now, here's where people are going to start to complain about this being a little too conspiracy theorist. Do you want to expand on that? We've got about 15 minutes left, by the way. I just want to remind listeners that we're speaking with Fred Birks. He's a former presidential interpreter, served for 18 years in the State Department, and interpreted for President Bush and Clinton, and also Al Gore and Dick Cheney and Colin Powell and some others. Mind control, is this tinfoil hat stuff, or what?
Yes, I know.
What kind of evidence do you have about any of this? Where can people go to read about it, first of all?
Okay, yes, mind control is a trigger word for a lot of people. If you go to www.wanttoknow.info, you will find on our website very clearly researched information on mind control programs that were run by the CIA going back to the early 1950s. We list document numbers and page numbers of Freedom of Information documents that anyone can order.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we give exact directions for how to go order them yourself, which I have done myself, and there are approximately 20,000 pages worth of information on the CIA mind control programs.
Now, are these programs that were under consideration or that were actually carried out?
No, these were clearly carried out with large budgets.
Okay.
In fact, there were congressional investigations on them back in 1976, and you can order a copy of that congressional investigation and learn quite a few fascinating tidbits about how mind control can be used in various circumstances.
Now, typically, how long do people have to wait before a CIA document is released through and I don't mean current one, I mean, how many years usually does it take for a version to come out?
No, I was quite surprised. Because they, believe it or not, they get thousands of requests for these documents. They've actually condensed them down to 3 CDs through the Freedom of Information Act. It costs $30, which you send to the U.S. Treasury, and it takes roughly 3 weeks for them to arrive to you.
And so, but some of these are quite old. I mean, I guess the point I'm trying to get to is, if this stuff was going on in the 50s and 60s, when are we going to find out what's going on today?
oh, well, that's going to be much more difficult because of the Freedom of Information Act. But if you just used inference and look, this is what they were doing in the 50s and 60s, and you got lots of documents there, you can imagine that it's much more developed now.
And, of course, they have a much bigger budget now.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we know that there's torture going on at Guantanamo, or at least there has been, and that this is used in combination with drugs and hypnosis to promote mind control techniques. But I don't want to diverge too much into that area. Just know that there's lots of great, reliable, verifiable information on that at wanttoknow.info.
So I guess the big picture for all of this is that there is a small group of people who have the majority of the money and the majority of the influence and power across the planet, not just in this country. And I guess that the hard thing to document or prove is that they're somehow working together. How do you go about explaining or proving the idea that there is a larger picture going on? Is this, you know, smoke-filled rooms with darkened meetings between these elites, or is it just a matter of convenience because there's money to be made?
Well, here's where I distinguish myself from the conspiracy theorists. A typical conspiracy theorist believes that there's a small group of power elite running the world, and they make plans back in smoke-filled rooms that cause everything to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I do not see things this way at all. Yes, there are small groups of power elites, but they are fighting against each other for power, sometimes working in uneasy alliances for the benefit of both of them, and other times fighting against each other to see who can get the most money, power, and everything else that they want.
Now, of course, the perfect example for me is of one of these uneasy alliances is the right-wing Christians and the Zionists.
Yes, exactly.
And if people don't understand that, can you just give me like a two-minute summary of why that's a strange alliance?
Yeah, well, this is a group that I named the Armageddonists, and there are a number of us who research this. We call them the Armageddonists. These are people who believe that what should happen is Armageddon.
Mm-hmm.
And this includes not only your fundamentalist Christians, but also fundamentalist Muslims and Jews. So these three groups all believe, you know, for the Christians, they believe it's the second coming of Christ. And that's going to bring about the whole transformation of society, and that's what they really want. The fundamentalist Muslims have similar views, and the Zionists are waiting for their savior who's going to save and change everything. So, again, this is one of those uneasy alliances where they don't really like each other's views so much, but they're all looking, wanting the same goal.
Now, I hate to be overstating the obvious, but why is it odd? I mean, what do you think is unusual for the secular or non-religious people out there? Why is it strange for a right-wing Christian and a Zionist to combine forces?
Well, you know, it's...
If they want to bring about the end of the world, assuming.
These people are very strongly convinced that their religion is the true and only religion.
Right.
So here you have a fundamentalist Muslim who's like, you know, Islam is the only way, and a fundamentalist Christian is one way.
Mm-hmm.
And the Zionists are, you know, we are the superior people. So all three of these think that they are right and the others are wrong, and yet they're working together in this alliance to sort of facilitate Armageddon coming.
And I guess to each one of those groups, Armageddon means the annihilation of the other groups.
Yes.
Or at least either the conversion...
They will then be saved by their savior. And, of course, each group has a different savior.
Right. I guess the conversion or the annihilation. Because
right.
There are some chances for those who are not believers, I guess, on Armageddon to change their ways.
But this is only one faction of the power elite. And this is where I say it's actually much more complex than most people would think. There are other factions vying for power. You know, there's the American wealth, the Rockefellers, and their whole group who, of course, have their own agenda. There's the Russians and the Chinese who have their own agendas. And then you have the intelligence communities in each of those places. And you find that many times intelligence agents become more loyal to each other than they are to their own country. So it gets quite complex. And as I say, the conspiracy theorists want to make it very simple. It's just, oh, the evil power elite versus us.
Now, of course, a lot of this is as old as human society itself. You know,
yeah.
Conspiracies and assassinations and things go back to the oldest empires that I can think of.
Absolutely.
I guess it's now with global communication and the ability to transfer people and funds and weapons, etc., over long distances very quickly. It just kind of makes the whole picture a little bit more complicated.
Exactly.
So, with this being, I mean, do you think that this is really part of human nature? Is this the way societies tend to act? And is there anything we can do about it? How is it that every complex empire has fallen pretty much from within, either through assassination or corruption or whatever? And how How do we prevent that from happening in a modern setting where empires are not quite as easily defined as they used to be?
Right. Well, you know, humankind is still learning. We're continually growing, and we keep. If you look at it, you know, we were in a slave state just 150 years ago. We've made improvements. We continue to make improvements. But the key is to understand that it's this us versus them thinking and the fear-mongering that continues to create these conditions. And when we as a people, each one of us, are willing to go in and work towards realizing that every one of us has a heart. Every person in this world has a heart, and every person has a place where they just want to really be loved and cared for. And if we move from that place and change the mass consciousness of humanity, then all of the power structures will begin to change. But we've got to find the change from within, and the internet is creating the power for us to communicate and work together to help our humankind, the human race, to mature so that we don't have to be in war all the time.
So do you think that the best way to start this is where? Is it through maybe trying to change the education system, or is it trying to affect the media? Is it all done simultaneously? How? I guess what I'm asking for is some kind of plan of action or participation. What is it that you think people should do, and what are you doing yourself?
Well, because we just have very limited time, I want to recommend to answer that question, go to wanttoknow.info and click on two documents. One is A Brighter Future, which lays out clearly what's happening and what we can do about it. And another is You Can Help, where we give solid suggestions on what we can do to get the information out and work together to create a better world.
There's definitely a lot to read on there. Are there any other people whose work you like and whose work you would recommend based on your experiences, not only as part of the State Department, but what you've done since?
Sure, there are many, many people doing great work on the internet. And you can go to the resource list, and there it's not like a links list. Most people have, you know, thousands of links. We only list two or three very best in each field that we feel are doing excellent work to look at what's going on. For instance, David Ray Griffin, as you know, is an amazing person. And by the way, he found his original information on 9/11 on our website. I'm in personal contact with him.
Okay. Well, he's been on this show, I think, four times since his book first came out.
Yeah, he's
published
great.
A second one now, so I'm going to have to get him back on again soon to talk about that. He published a book on the 9/11 Commission to look at the holes in the investigation.
Yeah, I actually proofread that book for him, right.
Do you want to give us a summary of his main points in that book and give people a taster of what they're going to look forward to when we get him back on?
Basically, he says that there are many serious questions surrounding various parts of what happened on 9/11 that were not even touched on or just very lightly touched on and dismissed by the 9/11 Commission. And he gives you all the references. I think he has something like 40 pages of footnotes to go and check these things out. And by the way, most of the things he mentions you can find on our 9/11 summaries. On wanttoknow.info, we have a 2-page, 10-page, 25-page, and a 60-page summary, each summary giving one or two sentence facts, and then there's a link direct to the mass media website that reported this fact, and we only use the top media. So these are reliable sources, and if you read all of it in it together, you suddenly realize, oh my goodness, why isn't the press talking about this, the big picture? They're giving all of these little pieces here and there, but it's buried on page B26.
Well, before I ask you why you think that is, I'm just going to give one quick example. A very powerful argument, proving, I guess, for my sake at least, that the 9/11 Commission hasn't looked at a lot of the main issues, is Sybil Edmonds. She's mentioned in David Ray Griffin's
new book.
I've been
in communication with her as well, yes.
Well, and
she's a translator.
Yeah, I was hoping to get her on tonight because she won part of her case.
Yes.
But she says, and she said on the air on this show, that she saw intelligence translations that proved that the U.S. government knew Al-Qaeda would attack cities with airplanes, and they knew roughly when it was going to happen, and that these papers were dated April of 2001.
That's right.
So this is significantly before the event, and she gets, I think, one footnote in the 570-something pages of the 9/11 Commission report, and her testimony is secret, and they tried to retroactively classify even things like what languages she speaks.
That's right.
So, I mean, I think that there is, you know, for those listening out there who may be thinking that, you know, man, KPFT's gone off the edge here, and they think, you know, 9/11 was an inside job. I'm not making that accusation, but I am saying that there is a lot we don't know, and there's a lot that needs to be investigated, and there's a lot of information that's already available.
Yeah.
So my question then, going back to you, is we've got about 4 minutes left, is why is it that you think that the media doesn't attack these things head on? There is a lot of stuff available in the mainstream, but like you said, it's, you know, on the jump pages of the newspapers on 17C or whatever.
Right.
What is it that prevents them, and is it conscious?
Well, it has to do with the corporate media ownership. You find that the media has been narrowed down to about 7 or 8 huge conglomerates now, whereas just 15 years ago, there were over 50 organizations that made up the bulk of the media. And that these conglomerates are now owned by these factions of the power elite. So it's not that all of the reporters are in some conspiracy to not report this information. It's that when key pieces come out that could threaten, quote-unquote, national security, which means expose what's really going on, then it gets shut down by the top ownership. And in fact, you'll find there's a mass media cover-up summary on our website, which is the reporting of 20 award-winning journalists telling how they personally were shut down when they tried to report major stories. And if several of these journalists are Emmy Award winners. One is a Pulitzer Prize winner. Greg Palast is on there.
He's actually just got a message. He's on hold. He's going to be joining us in a couple of minutes.
Great.
So another one of these people is Christina Borgeson, who we had on this show very early on. And she wrote an excellent book. Well, she edited, I should say, an excellent book that people should read if they have time, called Into the Buzzsaw.
That's what our summary is. It's a summary of her book. There's a 2-page and 10-page summary of Into the Buzzsaw. If you go to the front page of wanttoknow.info, you can click and read it.
Now, Fred, I guess my last question for you is, you sound fairly upbeat and quite positive based on a lot of the things that you've been saying today. How is it that that is possible, and what is it that you see as being the potential to turn things around, if indeed that's your position?
Yeah, well, thank you. Actually, I am incredibly positive because I know that human nature in its core essence is good. And that when we all start realizing that we don't have to live in fear, that we can start trying to connect more deeply with all of us and stop looking at it as us versus them, we can transform this whole thing. It's already happening all over the internet. There's all sorts of wonderful websites and activities where people are coming together saying, we can build a better world, and they're already doing it. So I encourage everyone to find ways. Every one of us can make a difference. Don't be afraid of what's going on, and try not to say, oh, they're doing this, and make yourself a victim by blaming others. Let's work on our own selves and find your own spiritual path, and then we can really work together to create a wonderful, beautiful world. And it's going to take some years, yes, but I know that we can and will do this.
Well, on that very positive note, I want to thank you again for joining us. There's a lot of material to get through. The website, one more time, for people who have web connections?
Sure, it's wanttoknow.info. That's all one word, www.wanttoknow.info.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Fred Burks, former presidential interpreter, 18 years with the State Department, interpreted for presidents and vice presidents and various others. Wanttoknow.info is the website. Go and visit if you have time. It's covered with a lot of very interesting stuff and will lead you to many other sites. One of the names that Fred just mentioned is our next guest. That is Greg Palast. We're going to take a very short break and come back, and we'll be joining him live for about 15 minutes at the end of the show. Stay tuned. Listening to the Sunday Monitor, and rounding out the show for us tonight, we have a live interview with BBC journalist, Guardian reporter, investigative muckraker extraordinaire Greg Palast. Welcome back to the Sunday Monitor.
Hey, Mark. Glad to be with you.
It's been a while since we've had you on. I know you've been really busy. I tried to leave you alone. In the end, I guess a confluence of stories that I felt you would be as good a source as any to help people understand.
Usually I'm called in for the effluent of stories. Go right ahead.
Well, maintaining the upbeat mode. Actually, I mean, I wanted to ask you...
That guy was really happy.
Yeah. Fred's a good guy.
I got a $65 parking ticket here in New York City. So, you know what I mean? So, okay. But anyway, I'll keep an upbeat view of it.
Well, you know, I've always appreciated the way you manage to mix humor with very serious and quite often depressing stories.
You want me to cry?
Well, I hope not.
Okay, good.
On a very serious note, yeah. I guess what I wanted to start with was Hunter S. Thompson. He passed away very recently. You wrote an article about him and your experiences with him. Just kind of give us a background of who he was, what he meant to you, and why this is such a big loss to the media in general, and I guess to a wider society. Who was he?
Yeah, well, Hunter Thompson is, you know, for those who love these terms, he was the kind of inventor of gonzo journalism, and all that meant is just write what you really want to write. I think he put it, you know, which is amazing. He wrote what he really thought, really felt, and really saw without any concept of restriction at all, and assumed that that's the end of his career. But then instead it propelled him into ultra super stardom. As he said, you know, it was like falling down an elevator shaft and landing in a pile of mermaids. So, you know, in other words, he lucked it. And he did one thing. He wrote for the Texas Observer, and I want to actually give a special applause to your guys down there, because to Ronnie Duggar, who was the founding editor of Texas Observer, which and found such people for us as Hunter Thompson, Molly Ivins, Jim Hightower, you know, Lou DeBose, many really sharp people who were generated out of that wasteland down your way.
It sounds like you're reading a list of my previous guests. I've had all of those people on, with the exception of Hunter Thompson, who I was actually supposed to have on next month. So.
Oh, well, you know, I was actually, ironically, I was hoping to get together with him next month. I was going to be out in Colorado. I'll be out in Boulder next month. Go to my site, gregpalace.com, you can get that info. And on the other hand, one of the things I was writing about was, ultimately, I mean, he's a guy who committed suicide this last Sunday, a tragedy, but you have to understand that he'd been kind of in the process of suicide now for a good decade and a half through, you know, I mean, famously, you know, his ingestion of alcohol, booze, and of booze and drugs and bullets. I mean, he was he loved the guns, and being around a lot of people who do serious alcohol and guns, the two usually end up in some tragedy. And one thing that I was very concerned about is the damage of celebrity. And if there was a guy who really had a tough time with being a superstar, it was Thompson. What happened was that he was a brilliant investigative reporter. I know he's working, when he wrote the book Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, he was working on an investigation of the death of Ruben Salazar in another muckraking journalist, Chicano, in Los Angeles. And he was doing brilliant stories. And then he did this kind of like, just, you know, kind of for the hell of it piece, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which if you haven't read it, you absolutely must, because then you just find out what the music of writing is about. And it was, and that propelled him to hipster stardom. So, so it was just a kind of goof off piece, so that, you know, he no longer had to do the heavy lifting stuff. And what happened was he started writing. He became more and more of a celebrity. He was a celebrity writer and became more a celebrity and less a writer. Not that such a thing would happen to me, but you know, it's something. And I said that was really ultimately deadly to his writing, where he couldn't even sustain a book by the end. Stuff began to be a parody of itself. So the writing of the last few years is pretty much pathetic, except that he was a brilliant. He still had that ability to kind of you know, turn on the ray gun. And just, you know, just get right through the BS and get right through the, you know, right through to the hard stuff, and being able to see the world as it was. He could no longer really investigate or write. His subjects, because he was such an outsized character, his subjects were almost, everything was too small for him. So his writing kind of collapsed. And I was talking about the danger of celebrity, and interestingly enough, the only letter I got of complaint about how celebrity can make you a jackass was from Michael Moore. But, you know, so it's kind of interesting. I won't comment on the psychology.
I was just going to ask you if you get to share the contents of that letter, but maybe you'd rather not. He's definitely going to be missed. You know, he had a rare gift of phraseology. He used one of his phrases at the beginning, and it's a shame to see him go.
Well, I've stolen phrases from him left and right. I mean,
give us a couple of your favorite quotes.
Well, in fact, I was just writing a chapter in my new book. Those who read The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, my first. You might see a little of Thompson stuff purloined here and there, but I was thinking about Zell Miller. Now, mm-hmm. Zell Miller is was the senator from Georgia, the so-called Democrat who nominated George Bush at the last convention. So he was a jackal in Democrats' clothing.
What is a Dixiecrat?
And exactly, worse than a Dixiecrat, because at least a Dixiecrat was still a Democrat. I mean, no Dixiecrat would have nominated, you know, gone to Richard Nixon's, would have nominated Richard Nixon. They might have secretly admired the man. But I was thinking about that guy, and I was thinking, because I once said at a Pacifica fundraiser for Dennis Bernstein's Flashpoints, discussing Zell Miller, who had destroyed the Democratic Party in Georgia and went after Cynthia McKinney with lies about Cynthia McKinney, the black congresswoman. And I said on Flashpoints that, it's terrible that the Democratic Party has now had two elections stolen from it, that any political party which nominates a brain-damaged vulture like Zell Miller deserves every beating it gets.
Hmm.
And that was, of course, for those who recognize, it was a steal from Hunter, who wrote about Hubert Humphrey, who wrote about the Democrats and Hubert Humphrey, that said that any political party which nominates a brain-damaged vulture like Hubert Humphrey deserves every beating it gets.
Right.
And so, you know, I just couldn't write it better than Hunter. So, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, another absolute classic you have to read. But I got a lot of good hate mail from some of his fans, because you have to understand, as a guy writing myself and stealing as much as I can from him, obviously I'm not only sympathetic and feel this loss deeply, but I'm sympathetic for the problems that he suffered of being unable to he couldn't hold his liquor, but he definitely couldn't hold his celebrity. And it's a dangerous and damning thing. And I'm not one of these people to say his public killed him, because that's kind of it's a little fey. It's not right. But on the other hand, it's dangerous stuff. It's a real drug. I mean, it's the only celebrity is the only drug which is more powerful than television.
Well, on that note, we're gonna shift gears a little bit, because I want to talk to you about some other things. We've got about 7 minutes left. I want to remind people that I'm speaking with Greg Palast. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, BBC journalist, Guardian reporter, and a bit of a muckraker, I guess. If you're not too offended by that term, it's something.
I'm not offended. In fact, actually, I have to say that I recently the patron of the Philosophical Society of Trinity College, which is an award given to kind of writers in trouble, troubled writers like Jonathan Swift and Oscar Wilde, and I got this nice little award.
Which Trinity College are we talking about?
Trinity College, Dublin.
Okay.
For Jonathan Swift to be given an award, it would have had it couldn't have been. An American college.
You're in good company though with those guys.
But well, the thing is that I got the award only because Hunter Thompson turned it down. So I have to say that. So I was happy to get Hunter's sloppy seconds when it comes to journalism awards. So go ahead. What's the question number six for this muckraker?
Well, the second topic, in the 5 minutes we have left, is Hugo Chavez. In the beginning of the news, I reported how the Venezuelan Foreign Minister Ali Rodriguez was warning just a couple of days ago that the Bush administration may be trying to plot to overthrow the Chavez government. And I guess the question to you is, have these guys gone off the deep end? What's going on in Venezuela? And why would Chavez and Rodriguez have reason to believe that this is happening? And I'm phrasing this in such a way so that you can give me some past evidence, because I know there is some.
Well, the thing is, I'm not even sure on this one. It's a mixed bag. First of all, Ali Rodriguez, who I know pretty well, as well as I do know Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. Rodriguez was the head of OPEC. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the foreign minister, remember, you're talking to Mr. Oil. The what you have to understand is that the OPEC meeting is coming up on the 16th in Iran, where they are going to reset the price of oil and the conditions for oil. Now, this is a dangerous time always for Chavez, because Venezuela is the swing nation in OPEC. It is, people don't realize that the key nation in OPEC is not Iran, except for, well, after Saudi Arabia.
Venezuela actually gives the U.S. about a quarter of its oil, just for people's information.
And Texas and the Houston area is completely dependent on the heavy oil coming out of Venezuela. Your town, actually, your refineries there, the Exxon refinery, can't process anything but Venezuelan oil. It needs heavy oil. That's what your refineries down there are set up for, is to receive that Venezuelan oil.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very important that keep flowing through. Chavez has been basically at war that he didn't ask for with the Bush family. He got along very, very well, by the way, with Bill Clinton and with Daddy Bush. He's good friends with Senior Bush. But the Junior and the neocons have been out for him because he's really the dissident, not only creating problems for Bush at OPEC, but the dissenter from the New World Order. Now, there was.
I just want to give people a little bit of background. There was actually a coup attempt recently, and he survived it. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what happened there?
April 2002, Chavez was kidnapped.
Uh-huh.
And now it's quite clear that the U.S., in fact, the National Security Archives, was able to get the ultimate documents proving that the U.S. was deeply involved in the attempt to in the kidnapping, what would have been the murder of Chavez, except he outsmarted these guys. That's a story worth going into itself at another point. You can get it at gregpalace.com. But
we've got about 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
Greg.
So the important thing here is that I would not, Hugo Chavez himself might, for dramatic purposes, say that the U.S. is out to get me. Ali Rodriguez is one of the straightest, most conservative talking guys you will ever encounter, and I think that they're very, very concerned about who's going to control what at OPEC. And here's the surprise little thing that you won't expect, which is that, in fact, we're not concerned. This administration is not concerned that the price of oil is too high. They're afraid, I think, that Chavez is going to push it lower. The U.S. want the Dick Cheney and George Bush are very happy with high oil prices, despite the fact that it's cost the U.S., most calculations say it's cost us about 1 million jobs here. But remember, whose million jobs are they? Those are the old, those are blue state jobs.
Don't forget, an average of 60% increase in profits for the oil companies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, record upon record. Every major oil company on the planet has reported, crazy record all-time profits. And so this is an issue that we do have to be concerned with. So, in fact, I'll be down Houston way pretty soon to be filming some of this in preparation for the OPEC meeting.
Great. Well, maybe we'll get a chance to meet when you're down here. When is your next book going to be out, do you think?
Well, it'll be actually not out till the beginning of next year.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely keep an eye out for it, and I'd love to meet with you and chew the cud in Texas style when you arrive. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Mark, I really appreciate the opportunity. Bye.
Thanks for doing this. Okay, that was Greg Palast, BBC journalist. He writes for The Guardian. You can go to his website, gregpalast.com. There's a lot of good stuff on there. If you follow the link to Latin America, like I said, you'll see a lot of things on Hugo Chavez. Before him, we had Fred Burks, a former presidential interpreter. That does it for this week's show. I'm Mark Ribawi, and I want to thank Byron Jackson for his assistance. Pokey Anderson should be joining us next week, and I want to spend a minute here or so thanking her for all of her hard work. I know she wasn't here to bask in the afterglow of a successful fundraising drive. We did well, and I want to thank everyone who pledged. We really appreciate it. I also want to send our best wishes to Pokey's father, who has not been all that well recently, but he's on the mend, and hopefully he'll be back out and causing trouble very soon. This is KPFT Houston. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Pan-African Journal with Akua Holt, and join us again next week at 6. Good night.